Okay, then. Good morning, then, brethren. Once more today, in case you're listening to this as a taped message in future years, is day number 7, which is technically the final day of the Festival of Tabernacles, and tomorrow is a separate feast, the 8th day, the last great day. So today I've chosen to speak about, actually to go through the book of Ruth in the Bible. So I've entitled it Ruth-a-Refresher, a refresh in the sense that we have been through the book of Ruth a number of years ago, so we're sort of refreshing what we covered then. But there's a sort of particular reason why I think it, for me at least personally, it almost helps to picture the world to come, because when I started reading the Bible all the way through many, many years ago, I'd not come across Ruth. I don't think I'd heard of Ruth at the time, probably a teenager, and I started in Genesis, as you tend to do, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, and Judges. Now, Judges was really the most miserable book. It was just full of war, killing, backstabbing, you know, rape, pillaging. It was an awful book. And I got to the end of that book, I just thought, I feel really down, because, you know, it's almost like the world today. And then I read the 4-chapter book of Ruth, and I thought, oh, that's really great. It was such a peaceful book of sort of a romance and doing good, and a sort of a lovely rural scenes and setting, that to me it was a very refreshing book, particularly since I read it immediately after Judges. So in a sense, to me, you could say the world we live in today is not dissimilar to the horrific world of Judges. The world that's coming fairly soon now will be as beautiful, as peaceful, as idyllic, well, actually much more so than the book of Ruth. So that's the reasons for it. Let's just look at the last verse of the preceding books, Judges chapter 21 and 25. So after 21 chapters of nightmare experiences for the people of Israel, we see the reason given in verse 25. It says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." And that summarizes why the world then, society then, was as bad as it was. And it probably actually is not a bad summary of the world today. The world that we live in today, every man does that which is right in his own eyes. Whether that's abortions, homosexuality, whether it's gender fluidity, you name it, this world today, people just do what they want to do. Nobody wants to hear what God's got to say on a subject, and to a degree, people who've got Christian beliefs, biblical beliefs, are being probably more and more marginalized. It's not something that the world wants to hear. We do things our way. We're modern and progressive. So the world to come, it won't be that way. So let's open at Ruth, so chapter 1, and we're probably going to read pretty much through the book of Ruth if we don't run out of time. So starting in chapter 1 and verse 1. "Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his 2 sons. The name of the man was Elimelech. The name of his wife was Naomi. The names of his 2 sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to the country of Moab and remained there." So here's the beginning of what turns out to be quite an unfortunate story to begin with. There's a famine in the land, and Bethlehem, where these people dwelt, is in the, sort of, the southern part of Israel. You've got Galilee up in the north, drop all the way down to sort of Jerusalem, and then south of Jerusalem a few miles, you've got Bethlehem. Famine in the land, and they decide to move away to Moab, which is about 50 miles or something sort of north and heading east of the country. Ironic in a sense that the name Bethlehem in Hebrew means the house of bread. Clearly there wasn't any, so that's ironic. And off they go. The names are interesting. Elimelech means "my God is king." Okay. Naomi means pleasant, a delight. But the boys' names definitely curious. Malon means sick, and kilion means dying or pining away. Thinking, why would you call your two boys sick and dying? It's like naming them today. Well, you could be called flu. I'm going to call you pleurisy. It's not the sort of thing you would think of naming your children. Now, was it wise to move to Moab? Clearly not everybody moved there, because there's a whole bunch left, you know, later in the story. Did Elimelech and Naomi, did they count the cost? You know, here we are with our people, surrounded by family. But for whatever reason, you know, they thought about it, and one or both of them made the decision, let's move the family to where there's food. This is a great idea. So off they go. Verse 3, then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left, and her two sons. She's now the widow Naomi. Now they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, the name of the other Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. Oops. Then both Mahlon and Chilion, Mr. Sick and Mr. Dying, they also died. And so the woman survived her two sons and her husband. So this is pretty unfortunate. Orpah means gazelle, and Ruth means friendship. Those sound like okay names to me. But notice at this point, all the men have died. Naomi's husband has died. Her two boys, two young men, I guess, at this stage. They've been married by now, and a number of years has passed. All the men have died, leaving three widow ladies, which in those days I don't think would be, you know, particularly good, because you get no breadwinner in the family any longer. There were three, now there's none. And of course, there's no social security in those days. You don't go along to the government office and say, well, I need money to help me out. It's not going to happen. So these ladies are really pretty vulnerable. Let's continue the story then in verse 6. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited or aided his people in giving them bread. So actually things have turned out okay back at home. Therefore she went out from the place where she was and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go, return each to her mother's house, and the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband, in the future, clearly. And then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, surely we will return with you to your people. We will come back with you. And this is their mother-in-law. But Naomi said, no, turn back, my daughters. Why would you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb, that they may be your husbands? You know, I'm going to have children in the future, and you're going to wait for them to grow up to be 18 or 20 or 25. That's not going to happen, girls. Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I'm too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope of a husband, even if I should have a husband tonight and should also bear sons, would you wait for them till they were grown? These were the days when, you know, families would expect potentially a brother to step in and fill the shoes of a dead brother. But she's saying, well, that's not going to happen. You're not going to wait 25 years, even if, forget it. Would you restrain yourselves from having husbands? You know, in the meantime, no, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. And, you know, it'd be standard in those days for people to think God's done this to me. Because, you know, in those days, people had pretty limited understanding of God and his ways. At that stage, there's only been, you know, 6 books of the Bible written. So, and she probably never read any of them because, you know, handwritten copies possessed by very few people. So she would have little knowledge, just was passed down, you know, from person to person. So she sort of thinks God's behind this. We would know, you know, different to that. You know, God is not out to bring trouble, you know, on people. Look at James chapter 1. verses 16 and 17. James chapter 1. And of course, a lot of people today, you know, blame God for hurricanes, for earthquakes, for murders, for assassinations. You know, God's involved in everything under the sun. Of course, God can judge, and that's his prerogative. But most of the time, people just blame God because that's convenient for them. But James 1, verses 16 to 17, it says, "Don't be deceived, my beloved brethren. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning." You know, God is consistent. He is dependable. And it says in verse 17, every good gift, every perfect gift comes from the unchanging Father in heaven. So we can understand, I think, going back to Ruth, Naomi's viewpoint. It's not accurate, but you don't know what you don't know, do you? So verse 14, "Then they," the girls, "lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, 'Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people," Orpah's gone back, "and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law.' But Ruth said, 'Entreat me not to leave you.'" You know, don't force me to leave you. Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from following after you. "For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, your God, Elohim, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts you and me." Which is a, you know, beautiful statement, and you can see the sort of the loyalty and the faithfulness of Ruth, whose name is friendship. That's what Ruth means, and you know, friendship, faithfulness, loyalty. In a sense, of course, you think that's how, you know, we should be towards Jesus. And wherever Jesus goes, we go. We're behind him all the way, and so it's a fantastic attitude that Ruth displays. She obviously does stand out very much as a woman, as a virtuous woman. Verse 18, "And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her." Okay, she can see this girl's not for turning. This girl is coming with me, come hell or high water. Verse 19, "Now the two of them went until they came to Bethlehem. And it happened when they had come to Bethlehem that all the city was excited because of them. And the women said, 'Is this Naomi?'" You know, is this the pleasant, delightful woman that we knew? "So she said to them, 'Do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara,'" meaning bitter, "For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me," in her view. And we can understand that. "I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. Why do you call me pleasant, Naomi, since the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has afflicted me?" Again, she's quite convinced. You know, everything that happens, happens because God does it. And she's inaccurate, but I understand that. Verse 22, "So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab. Now they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest," which turns out to be quite significant in terms of the season of the year. So that's going to be sort of springtime. Barley, one of the earlier crops to be harvested, and probably not a bad time necessarily to arrive, because it leads us into chapter 2. "And Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech, and his name was Boaz." Not Booz. Sounds similar, but Boaz means "in him is strength." So whereas the two boys were called flu and pleurisy, or, well, actually, sickness and pining, this guy's called "in him is strength." Ooh, and he's wealthy. So here's a wealthy man who's almost named strong strength. And some commentators have said they think there's an implication here, I think a slight one, he may have been a man of war. So, you know, you get the impression, strong, powerful, dominant, you know, wealthy individual. And whereas Elimelech had decided to leave the region because of the famine, you know, Boaz was staying. This is my territory, my region, I'm staying here. So different decision and obviously, you know, a different outcome. So Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, "Please let me go to the field and glean heads of grain after him in whose sight I may find favor." And she said to her, you know, "Go, my daughter." And we know there was a law for poor people, I think we covered it just a few weeks ago, that when you went through a field, if it was your field, you couldn't go through it twice. You could go through it once carefully, but anything that dropped on the ground, you had to leave there. If you're into an orchard and were taking, you know, apples or things off the trees, or you know, grapes from the vineyard, you couldn't go back and pick up the ones you missed. You had to leave them there. They were for the poor people. The poor people in those days, you didn't just go up to the house and give them a check. They had to sort of cooperate. So the poor people had to do a bit of work. They had to go out into the fields, find what was left, and they could gather the bits and pieces that were there. If you hold your place and look at Leviticus 19 and 9. Leviticus 19:9. "When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings," the bits and pieces that sort of fall off of the back of the wagons and so on, "of your harvest." You've got to leave that there. That's for other people. Deuteronomy 24, verses 19 to 21. Deuteronomy 24, and verses 19 to 21. "When you reap the harvest in your field and forget a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive trees, you shall not go over the boughs again." You don't do it twice. "It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not glean it afterwards. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow." And here, of course, we have two widow ladies, Naomi and Ruth. So Ruth appears to know the lie of the land, so to speak. She's going to go off and do some work. Verse 3, Naomi says, "Go, my daughter." That's a good idea. Off you go. Because what else are these ladies going to do? I mean, there's no breadwinner. You know, perhaps Naomi could offer to do some ironing for the neighbours. Perhaps she could offer to do some washing and, you know, get some produce from the back of that. But they're going to struggle, these ladies. Verse 3, "Then she left and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech." Just happened that way. There's fields all around Bethlehem. She could wander into any field and see where the people were out there reaping and bringing in the barley harvest and just go behind them a bit. But it just so happens that she stumbles into the field that belongs to Boaz. "Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, said to the reapers, 'The Lord be with you.' And they answered him, 'The Lord bless you.'" Which, you know, sort of reading the lines there, that's quite an interesting, you know, interplay. Boaz, the wealthy man whose name means strength, says, "The Lord bless you, you know, my workers, my employees," and they shout back, "The Lord bless you too." You get the impression this must be quite, you know, quite a chivalrous man, to have such good rapport and using God's name in a good sense. Then Boaz, verse 5, said to the servant who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" Probably pointing to the girl he didn't recognize. So the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered and said, "It's the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab." And she said, "Please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves." So she came and has continued from morning until now, though she rested a little in the house, or the tent, I think that actually is. So she had a bit of a break in the morning. I imagine it's hard work. I don't like bending over, picking things up in the garden, picking up when I've mowed the lawn. You know, bend over for a few minutes, and, oh, back's aching. So if you're going to bend over for hours, perhaps in the warm sunshine or hot sunshine, it's like, oh, yeah, okay, I wouldn't mind a break every now and then. Verse 8. Then Boaz said to Ruth, you will listen, my daughter, will you not? Do not go to glean in another field, nor go from here, but you stay close by my young women. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Have I not commanded the young men not to touch you, not to trouble you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink from what the young men have drawn. So straight away, this guy is standing out. He's saying to young woman, you stick here. No other fields, this field only. Behind my guys, my ladies, you're with them. Okay, got that? And she's going to nod. And by the way, when you get Thursday, you know, don't worry about it. Don't struggle over there. See all those bottles of sparkling water lined up? Yours. Help yourself. And very chivalrous. A really nice guy. That's what you think. This guy is standout guy. Because he only just met her for the first time. He doesn't know much about her. Then she fell on her face, bowed down to the ground, and said to him, why have I found favor? Or grace is the word, of course, we can use. And maybe it says grace in the King James. Can't recollect. Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me? Since, you know, I'm not a Jew, I'm not a Jewess, I'm a foreigner. And Boaz, what she'd look like at this stage. You know, she's been out for a number of hours. She's probably all, you know, red-faced and perspiring. She's got her working dungarees on because she's laboring for hours out in the fields. Hair's probably under some sort of wrap of some kind. She may not look the most outstanding beauty, but he says, you stay here, you follow my guys, you drink over there, you're safe here. And she says, you know, why am I getting this uncalled for, unearned grace and favor from you? And Boaz answered and said to her, it has been fully reported to me all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you have left your father and your mother and the land of your birth, and have come to a people whom you did not know before. So actually, he's heard the story. He hasn't met her before, but it's not going to be a big town, this. I mean, Bethlehem in these days, it can't be more than a few hundred people, you know, topside. And a wealthy businessman, landowner like Boaz, he's going to know that's happening. And he's heard that he would know Naomi. After all, he's a family of Elimelech, which was her husband. So he's heard about the return of Naomi. Oh, she's widowed. And, oh, young woman's come with her. Really? All the way from her home. Well, that's very good. That's very noble. And now he's met her. Verse 12, the Lord repay your work, and a full reward be given you by Jehovah, God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. So he speaks very highly of her. He knows her character already from what he's heard. Then she said, let me find favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants. Now Boaz said to her at mealtime, come here. You know, come right up to the top table here. Come here and eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar. Strange custom, but I'm sure it made sense in those days. Vinegar and oil and dipping bread in it. I have done that. That's nice. If you get some lovely bread and you get some olive oil and a bit of balsamic vinegar. Now that is nice, I'll admit. So perhaps it's something, you know, similar in those days. Now Boaz said to her at mealtime, come here, eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar. So she sat beside the reapers and he passed parched grain to her, and she ate and was satisfied, and she kept some back. And when she rose up to glean, you know, after the mealtime, Boaz commanded his young men, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves, and don't reproach her, don't rebuke her. If she comes right up to where the sheaves are, and she's actually plucking stuff off those, rather than hanging 50 yards behind and just picking up the bits off the ground, you let her do that. She can come right into the sheaves. Don't criticize her. Also, verse 16, let some grain from the bundles fall purposely for her. Leave it that she may glean, and don't rebuke her. So, what's going on here? I can't imagine at this stage there's anything other than just a very generous guy. he's a good guy. Here's a young widow lady who's left, her home and her parents and her God, and she's come to support Naomi, whom Boaz, clearly will know. I think he's just so impressed. He just says, I want to be good here and generous here. And so here she is. She's probably had her best meal for ages. Parched corn, whatever that is. Fantastic. Vinegar, wow, superb. The top vinegar. So here's two righteous people, really. Boaz is a very wealthy man, but he's clearly righteous, generous, noble, chivalrous. And here's a very poor young woman, Ruth. But she's righteous and faithful and supportive. So it's not a question of, in God's eyes, of wealth or poverty. It's not really the key thing to God. It's the fact that both of these people actually are rather righteous people. So dropping down to verse 17. So she gleaned in the field right until evening time. That's going to be all day, I guess, from roughly dawn till evening, to beat out what she had gleaned. And it was about an ephah of barley, which means nothing to me as a non-farming person. She took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned, so she brought out and gave to her what she had kept back after she had been satisfied from the noon meal. Now, I reckon that an ephah of barley is about between 30 pounds weight and 50 pounds weight, which would be roughly the equivalent of 2 weeks' wages for an agriculture worker in those days, which she'd collected in one day. So it's quite a lot. She's got the equivalent of 2 weeks' earnings in one day, because Boaz says, make sure you drop stuff around, plenty of it, guys. Make sure she... And she comes home with this bundle of stuff, and probably Naomi's thinking, what? Look at that. Her mother-in-law said to her, where have you gleaned today? Where did you work? Blessed be the one who took notice of you. Because she was probably expecting, a little tiny few handfuls of, grain. And here comes Ruth, probably staggering under the weight. sort of 30, 40, 50 pounds of grain over her shoulders. Like, what? Where have you been? Who did you bump into? So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, the man's name with whom I work today is Boaz. Then Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, oh, blessed be he of the Lord, who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead. And Naomi said to her, the man is a relative of ours, one of our near kinsmen. I think the Hebrew is Goel, G-O-E-L, meaning kinsman or kinsman redeemer. It would have a special legal status in those days, insofar as because he was a Goel, because he was a kinsman redeemer, Boaz would have certain legal rights. Not mandatory. It's not something he would have to do, but a kinsman redeemer, a nearby kinsman of this type, would be able, if he chose, to have legal rights to step in and provide help. We'll get to that in a bit. Verse 21, then Ruth the Moabitess said, he also said to me, you shall stay close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest. And of course he told the young men, don't molest her, right? She's young, she's a widow, I don't want any of you guys, right? And since his name was in him his strength, and he was very wealthy, and obviously they can say, yes, sir. Okay, she's okay, got that. And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it's good, my daughter, that you go out with his young men and that people do not meet you in any other field. So she stayed close by the young women of Boaz to glean until the end of barley harvest and wheat harvest, and continued to dwell with her mother-in-law. So that's a number of weeks so leading up to, I guess, sort of Pentecost time, Shavuot, the Feast of First Fruits, all that sort of time. And I'm just thinking here that, if you speculate a wee bit and say that she got 2 weeks' wages in that first day she was out, if she did that every day for 6 days, obviously Sabbath and all rest, then in the 7 weeks, let's say from roughly the start of the harvest up till Pentecost time, she'd probably have earned about a year's income in 7 weeks, because this guy is making sure there's plenty of surplus lying around for her. And of course, the 7 weeks or thereabouts elapses, perhaps from, sort of the wave sheaf time up to, Pentecost, Feast of Harvest time. I think it's that time of the year we're talking about. Of course, the harvest is now pretty much over. The weeks have elapsed, and she's brought back a lot of stuff. And I guess probably Naomi is able to sell some of the surplus stuff for other items. But the time has elapsed. 7 weeks has passed. And Naomi's probably thinking, what happens now with this potential relationship? She's mother-in-law. She can see scope here. And it could be once the harvest is over that people scatter. Boaz goes off somewhere else and his workers go off somewhere else. And no longer can Ruth just walk a couple hundred yards out into the field. So, time for mother-in-law to step in. Verse 1 of chapter 3. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you?" Because Naomi's obviously going to be a good mother-in-law, and she's thinking, well, this young woman's left her people, her God. She's come to look after me, which is really, really noble of her. We've been very blessed over the last few weeks. But what happens to Ruth now? What about Ruth's future? She's forfeited her own land. What can I do about Ruth? And got an idea here. Now, Boaz, whose young woman you were with, is he not our kinsman? There's a legal connection here. In fact, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Therefore, wash yourself and anoint yourself. So that's ointments, creams, perfume. Put on your best garment, Sunday best, we might call it. I don't suppose they called it Sunday best in those days. But your best garment, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Then it shall be when he lies down at the end of a long day, but a nice big feast in the evening, and he's had plenty to eat, and he's had a glass or two of the finest, Judean red wines. When he lies down, you shall notice the place where he lies. It's going to be dark, don't forget. So you have to just watch before all the candles are blown out and the oil lamps are blown out. Check where he lies down. And you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go in, uncover his feet, and lie down, and he will tell you what you should do. And she said to her, "All that you say to me, I will do." So Ruth, okay, fine, you know the score around here. Naomi, that's exactly what I'll do. Or maybe she was called Mara by this time. Now, of course, some of the customs don't exactly mean an awful lot, to us. But clearly when Boaz sees her this time, she's going to look somewhat different, because she's been out in her working duds in the field. So red face and sweat pouring down and all dusty, and now she's going to turn up wearing her finest garments, hair brushed and ornamented and smelling of sort of fine perfume. So he's going to think, who is this, when he sees her? So she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law instructed her. And after Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was cheerful, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came softly. I guess she probably had to wait a little while, perhaps to the sort of sound of snoring and so on, uncovered his feet and lay down. Now, it does seem culturally, according to the expert commentators, that this business of uncovering your feet and spreading your garment over somebody was tantamount to a proposal of marriage, as we'll see. She came, uncovered his feet, I guess lifted up the blanket, or maybe lifted up his garments and lay down. Now, it happened at midnight that the man was startled. He'd had a few glasses of wine, he was snoring happily, and, he turns himself, and there, a woman lying at his feet. What is this? A woman at my feet? My reputation. And of course, it's dark. He can't, there aren't any lights on. And he said, who are you? So she answered, I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing. That's like, marry me. For you are a near kinsman, or my margin says, redeemer. That'll be that word, goal. So she says, marry me. I think you can do that in leap years. I think the women can propose marriage, but normally it's the other way around. Verse 10, he said, blessed are you of Jehovah, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, and that you did not go after young men, whether poor or rich. The impression you get is that Boaz is a more mature man. I don't know, I'd throw out, maybe he's 40, 45, and he's saying, well, this is remarkable. You could have chased a young 25-year-old strapping farmer guy, but you've come to me, and now my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you request, for all the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman. So he's still a top-notch guy here. He says, I will look after you. You are a virtuous woman. That's the same term we get in Proverbs 31. And how do you recognize a virtuous woman? It's the same term exactly. And he says here, blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter. So he blesses her. He's still noble. He's still chivalrous. He's going to do what's required for her. Is that what some people class as legalism? He's got to do this? Well, no, the answer is he hasn't got to do it. He has legal rights. He doesn't have legal obligations because he's only a relative. He's not the brother. If we turn to Deuteronomy 25:5, hold your place there. Brothers, direct brothers, had legal duties. They call it the levirate marriage. So Deuteronomy 25:5. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother shall go into her, take her as his wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. So that's one of the customs of ancient Israel. But in this case, Boaz is not the brother, so he has no legal duty resting upon him. But he is a kinsman, he is a goel, he does have legal rights, and he's quite happy, to sort of offer to help. So this is not legalism where he must do something. This is him operating under, if you like, continued grace. This is loving kindness on his part. Verse 12. Now it is true that I am your near kinsman. However, there is a kinsman nearer than I. So he's not a brother. The other guy's not a brother either. But he's a bit closer in the family sort of connections. I think it was Charles Spurgeon, was it? He talked about that Boaz is an example of Jesus Christ. Because, Boaz is looking after the woman, looking after the wife. He's cherishing her. He's honoring her. So that Jesus Christ is our Boaz. That's the sort of picture that Charles Spurgeon developed. But here we are in verse 12. I am your near kinsman, but actually there's somebody else who's actually even nearer and whose legal opportunities therefore are even stronger. Stay this night, and in the morning it shall be that if he will perform the duty of a near kinsman for you, good, let him do it. But if he does not want to perform the duty for you, then I will perform the duty for you as the Lord lives. Lie down until morning. Now he's obviously a man of action. In the morning it's going to happen. Going to sort this out. So she lay at his feet until morning, and she arose before one could recognize another. So we're talking about sort of, very dusky There's some light there, but you wouldn't actually recognize more than just, you know, sort of shape of a person. You wouldn't be able to see the face necessarily. And he said, "Do not let it be known that the woman came to the threshing floor." Also, he said, "Bring the shawl that is on you and hold it." And when she held it, he measured 6 ephahs of barley and laid it on her, and she went into the city. This all happening while it's still pretty dark, because he's making sure her reputation isn't going to be affected by all of this. You know, nobody saw her coming, and actually nobody's going to see her leaving. But she's not going to leave empty-handed. He's given her plenty of top-notch, top-quality barley to take back with her. So when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, "Is that you, my daughter?" I guess still darkish. Then she told her all the man had done for her. I imagine Naomi was probably up all night. Sort of a little lamp burning, thinking, what's going to happen? Is it going to work out? Is he going to accept her? Is he going to rebuff her? I don't know. I'll just wait up. Maybe she'll be home soon. Maybe so, you know, and it's sort of dusky morning, sort of light. Here comes this woman. She probably knew who it was. But is that you, Ruth? And she told her all the man had done for her. And she said, "These 6 ephahs of barley he gave me. For he said to me, 'Do not go empty-handed to your mother-in-law.'" Then she said, Naomi said, "Sit still, my daughter, until you know how the matter will turn out. For the man will not rest until he's concluded the matter this day." Now, this guy is Boaz, in him who is strength, possibly a warrior man. And Naomi knows he'll take action. This is not going to take long. This guy is direct. He's out there, does it, it'll be fixed. One way or another, let's wait and see. Chapter 4 and verse 1. "Now Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there." And I think the gate is where the men of business and commerce and so on sat and made decisions, the gate of the city. "And behold, the near kinsman of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, 'Come aside, friend, sit down here.' So he came aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, 'Sit down here.' So they sat down." So you've got a bit of a number of guys here, sort of caucus. "And he said to the near kinsman, 'Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, sold the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. And I thought to inform you, saying, buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants and the elders of my people. If you'll redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not redeem it, this piece of land, then tell me that I may know. For there is no one but you to redeem it, and I'm next in line after you.'" So a piece of land, and the land would be important to these individuals. Here's a piece of land that's available. And do you want to redeem it? Do you want to buy it? Because if you don't, I'm next in line, so you've got the first call here, friend. And after you, if you don't want it, then I'm going to put my hand up for it. And he says, I will redeem it. Yeah, okay, I'll take that land. Then Boaz says, okay. "But on the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it from Ruth, the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead on his inheritance." So when you buy the land, it comes with a mother-in-law and other duties which you will then possess. And then Nikim said, hang on, second thoughts. "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my own inheritance." You know, if I have to have the land and it comes with a mother-in-law and a wife, so to speak, and I'm supposed to raise a family in that circumstance for her, then that puts the kibosh on my having my own lineage, which is what I prefer to do. Tell you what, you redeem my right of redemption, my legal right, for yourself, but I'm not going to do it. I cannot redeem it. So he sort of decides no. And maybe he's thinking about Ruth being a Moabitess. Maybe he's thinking, well, you know, it's a different culture. She's not one of us here, and, you know, she had another god before. So who knows exactly? So, you know, Boaz is not being unethical here. You know, he is a man who's honest. He's saying, look, you can buy the land. It's within your hands to do that. But if you do that, you must also accept it will come with Naomi. it will come with Ruth. And the expectation then is that you'll do the honest deed and raise a family with her. And obviously the guy says, thanks for being clear, no. Now this was a custom in former times of Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging to confirm anything. One took off his sandal and gave it to the other. And this was an attestation in Israel. Okay. I know throwing shoes around is an insult in some cultures, because I've seen that on the news reports occasionally. I think in Arab countries and so on, if you take your shoe off and throw it at a speaker, that's deemed to be a massive insult. Towards it's like, you know, okay, if it's a big shoe and it bounces off your brain, you might be annoyed. But if just some sort of smelly slipper flies by you, towards like, oh, okay. But, you know, in cultures, these things can be important. Therefore, the near kinsman said to Boaz, buy it for yourself. So he took off his sandal. And Boaz said to the elders and to all the people, you witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Kilion's and Mahlon's from the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth, the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, I have acquired as my wife to raise up the name of the dead on his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brethren and from the gate of his place. You are witnesses this day. And all the people who were at the gate, and the elders said, true, we are witnesses. We've seen this. We record it. The Lord make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah, the two who built the house of Israel, and may you prosper in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. May your house, so they're giving a blessing here, and the guy's a wealthy man already, clearly highly regarded by his employees and by the elders. May your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring which the Lord will give you from this still young woman. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And when he went into her, the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. So Boaz has sorted it out. He was a man of action. The morning after that encounter at the threshing floor in the wee small hours, he's out there, finds the guy, makes the offer. I suspect he probably was quite shrewd in the way he phrased the offer. But he got the outcome that he wanted. And it was honest and straightforward. So she bore a son, and then the women said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a near kinsman, and may his name be famous in Israel. And of course, the family was actually to be extremely famous. And may he be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is better than you, better to you than seven sons, has borne him. And of course, Ruth was utterly faithful. She was a great friend to her mother-in-law, a great spirit, a lovely young woman, which Boaz seemed to notice straight away. And she was virtuous. Boaz was virtuous. They must have made a really handsome couple. Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her bosom and became a nurse to him. Also, the neighbor women gave him a name, saying, this is a son born to Naomi, and they called his name Obed. He's the father of Jesse, who is the father of David, the king of Israel, the man after God's own heart, and the one who will actually rule Israel in the world tomorrow that we picture during these feast days. So, yeah, Ruth ended up pretty famous, really. She's, what's that, is that the grandma of David? Wonderful story. Now, this is the genealogy of Perez. Perez begot Hezron, begot Ram, begot Abinadab, begot Nashon, begot Salmon. Salmon begat Boaz. Boaz begot Obed, who begot Jesse. And Jesse begot David. So the end of this fairly brief, but I think really very pleasant and almost quite a sort of romantic, sort of rural little idyllic picture. We actually have now the lineage taking us to the man who will be king over Israel and the world tomorrow. And like I said earlier, if one way to approach this is to read the book of Judges, because that will leave you looking for some pills to pop. It's such a terrible history of violence and debauchery, and you know, it's horrible stories and judges. You get to this, it's like, oh my word, how beautiful. And it is, I think, in some ways, quite a nice little picture of the end of this age, when every man does that which is right in his own eyes. And we get to where perhaps, you know, like Mr. Spurgeon says, Jesus Christ is our Boaz. And we're going to have a great life with our husband in the world to come. Okay, with that, we'll conclude our quick review of the Book of Ruth.